Ukraine's president says Russia's weaponization is not just conventional.
The aggressor is weaponizing many other things, and those things are used not only against our country, but against all of yours as well.
Plus, a scathing new UN report on human rights paints a sobering picture of Russia's crackdown domestically on any political opposition.
Basically, this so-called Zachistka, well, the cleansing up operation of any dissenters, of anybody who would dare to express a different view, of anyone who just wants to criticize or even wants to discuss in the public domain decisions by the government.
And later in the program, the growing use of drones in attacks and for defense. Today is Wednesday, September 20th. From the Voice of America, this is Flashpoint Ukraine. Good evening. I'm Lori London in Washington. United Nations Secretary General Antonio Guterres told the Security Council on Wednesday that Russia's war in Ukraine is aggravating geopolitical tensions and divisions, threatening regional stability, increasing the nuclear threat, and creating deep fissures in our increasingly multipolar world.
Our world is becoming unhinged. Geopolitical tensions are rising. Global challenges are mounting, and we seem incapable of coming together to respond.
Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky attended the United Nations Security Council in person on Wednesday for the first time since Russia invaded Ukraine in February 2022. Before the meeting started, Russia's UN ambassador argued against Zelensky addressing the council. The chair this month, Albania's Prime Minister Edi Rama.
Coming from you, all this lecture of violating the rules in this building is quite an impressive shoot. But
to stabilize markets and guarantee food security.
Many times that the violation here is about President Zelensky speaking before the council members. There is a solution for this if you agree. You stop the war and President Zelensky will not take the floor.
The Security Council has met dozens of times on Ukraine over the past 19 months, but is unable to take any action as Russia is a veto power. At the UN General Assembly in New York Tuesday, U.S. President Joe Biden sought to convince world leaders that his vision of American leadership and multilateral approach to foreign policy will help solve the world's most pressing problems. He again denounced Russia's 2022 invasion of Ukraine as a violation of a core tenet of the UN Charter. VOA White House Bureau Chief Patsy Wiedekuswara has this report from New York.
Addressing the United Nations General Assembly on Tuesday, President Joe Biden renewed his call for international support for Ukraine.
If we abandon the core principles of the United States to appease an aggressor, can any member state in this body feel confident that they are protected? If we allow Ukraine to be carved up, is the independence of any nation secure?
This is the second year Biden has rallied for Ukraine in front of the world body. But amid global South concerns that Ukraine dominates a meeting at the cost of other challenges, Biden did not mention Russia's invasion until minute 22 of his 27-minute speech. While a majority of countries supported a resolution condemning Russia's invasion last year, many are increasingly concerned about the war's toll on global energy and food prices. There are now growing calls from the Global South to fast-track peace negotiations between Moscow and Kyiv.
We do not underestimate the difficulties in achieving peace.
But no solution will be lasting if it is not based on dialogue. I have reiterated that work needs to be done to create space for negotiations.
Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky made his own appeal in his first in-person appearance at the General Assembly since the invasion.
And it is a clear Russia's attempt to weaponize the food shortage on the global market in exchange for recognition for some, if not all, of the captured territories.
With leaders from China, France, Russia, and the United Kingdom skipping the summit, Biden is the only leader of a UN Security Council permanent member attending. He outlined U.S. efforts to mobilize resources for global infrastructure projects, reform international institutions to make them more inclusive, and address other global challenges.
Record-breaking heat waves in the United States and China. Wildfires ravaging North America and Southern Europe. A fifth year of drought in the Horn of Africa. Tragic, tragic flooding in Libya. My heart goes out to the people of Libya. That's killed thousands, thousands of people. Together, these snapshots tell an urgent story of what awaits us if we fail to reduce our dependence on fossil fuels and begin to climate-proof the world.
Activists say more needs to be done as thousands of them march outside, demanding that the Biden administration end new fossil fuel projects. Patsy Wira-Kuswara, VOA News, New York.
Operations at a Ukrainian oil refinery have been temporarily stopped following a Russian drone strike overnight that caused a fire. It was one of several drone attacks across Ukraine in the last 24 hours. We have an update from Anna Chernikova in Kyiv.
Another drone attack, another tough night for Ukraine and especially for some regions. In total, 24 drones were used by Russian forces over the night, and 17 drones were destroyed by Ukrainian air defense. However, some drones hit certain targets in Poltava region. Ukrainian officials confirmed that unfortunately there were several hits, and those hits were at the oil refinery in Poltava region. We know that there is still a working process to eliminate the consequences of this attack, and the fire workers and special team is working in order to make sure that everything is fine. But still, the company that was hit was temporarily stopped its operation.
And I understand Ukraine also, it looks like they've gone on the offense again near Moscow.
Well, there is information about two planes and one helicopter destroyed in Moscow region. And according to Ukrainian intelligence and the official comment by the Ukrainian intelligence, they said that unknown saboteurs blew up these planes and a helicopter. This event took place at the Chkalovsky airfield in Russia. And actually, these aircraft and helicopters that were hit were previously actively involved in shooting down drones attack over the Moscow region. So basically, this is what we know for the moment. Ukrainian intelligence somehow do not take responsibility, as we never get this, you know, direct confirmations from Ukrainian officials, but at least we have this comment about unknown saboteurs. So it could be that Ukraine somehow is involved. But again, we cannot verify this information independently and we cannot confirm it at this point.
Anna Chernikova reporting for VOA from Kyiv. You're listening to VOA's Flashpoint Ukraine. I'm Lori London. An expert commissioned by the UN's top human rights body says in her first report on Russia that the rights situation in the country has significantly deteriorated since President Vladimir Putin launched his war against Ukraine last February. Mariana Katarova, the special rapporteur mandated by the Human Rights Council, chronicled the domestic crackdown that has largely targeted critics of Putin's war, as well as other opposition voices in Russia. For details and analysis on the report, I spoke with Amnesty International Russia expert Natalia Prulutska.
First of all, huge credit to Special Rapporteur Mariana Katsarova, who at this very short period of time, she was only appointed in May, and she's already presented this compilation of information of indeed horrific violations of human rights in Russia. I think it's a must read for anyone that is interested in human rights situation, that would like to know more about what is going on. And it is also encyclopedia, I would say, of everything that is happening in terms of violation of civil and political rights in Russia. Of course, there's much more, and Madam Special Rapporteur does mention this, that the focus of this report is mostly civil and political rights. We, as Amnesty International, have been, of course, attracting attention to human rights violations in Russia for a long time, and together with other organizations, we have been flagging the deteriorating situation that, in our opinion, eventually led to the full-scale invasion of Ukraine. Indeed, if you look at what is happening in Russia, it's basically this so-called зачистка, the cleansing up operation of any dissenters, of anybody who would dare to express a different view, of anyone who just wants to criticize or even indeed wants to sort of discuss in the public domain of decisions by the government. This, of course, does very easy the job of the government to then go and invade the country under the disguise of protecting national interests, protecting people in Ukraine It's very ironic, isn't it? And the mythic fight neo-Nazism that has been declared was one of the sort of goals, right? What we've seen since the start of the war is that the situation has deteriorated to the extent where there's practically no free media left. There's practically no opposition activists left. And I'm leaving this caveat because there are still courageous journalists and courageous activists and politicians that are still trying to do what they can in Russia at the moment. And I think, and this also, again, the report draws attention to that. So it's not only the litany of violations for which Russian government should come to account and they should rectify the situation in accordance with the international law, but it is, I think, a depiction of very brave activism and sort of fights of the Russian civil society, of ordinary Russians. Some of them are, you know, prominent opposition politicians or prominent journalists, but many of the cases that we're encountering that are covered in the media are just ordinary people who would go and protest against the war in Ukraine or against other injustices and violations.
The report cites that it tracked human rights violations, indicating that more than 20,000 people were detained between February last year and June for participating in anti-war protests. That's a significant number of people to be detained.
That's right. I mean, some of those people, of course, not all of those people continue to be detained, but there have been thousands, probably tens of thousands of administrative cases and hundreds of criminal cases where people are prosecuted for just speaking out, expressing their opinion about the war against Ukraine. And, you know, these days, I think it is important to note that these protests continue and very often in very sort of creative way. For instance, we are working on the case of Alexander Skochelenko, who is an artist and who early when the conflict has just started, she changed the price tags in the supermarket. So instead of price, there would be like, for instance, figures, X amount of, for instance, soldiers have been killed or X amount of civilians have been killed. She's prosecuted for that. She's standing trial for that. There are also other people, graffiti artists, just ordinary people who would use very creative ways of how to word their slogans when they go into single-person pickets. And it's interesting to notice that, you know, while in the beginning of the invasion, you know, there were mass protests, of course, then after all the legislation has been passed and, you know, people were prosecuted, the mass protests were not happening and many sort of put it as a sort of blame to the Russians as a whole, right, to the Russian civil society, you know, how come you're not protesting? But at the same time, I think people who are saying that, they don't notice all those courageous individuals or, you know, those who participate in small-scale pickets, protests, still, you know, up to this day against the war. And I think it takes even more courage to go out there on your own with a piece of paper to say what you want to say about this government and, you know, this aggression against independent country than to go together with hundreds of thousands of other people.
The report also said that over half of all protesters who were arrested for what it called peaceful anti-war activism were women, and that the rapporteur had received credible reports of a litany of rights violations that included torture, allegations of rape and sexual violence, threats of sexual violence by law enforcement officers against men and women. But I think it's pretty significant that over half of the protesters that were arrested were women.
Yes, and women actually, it's interesting how women have taken very prominent role in this protest. There is feminist anti-war resistance. There are other organizations and movements, women's organizations and movements that are speaking out against the atrocities in Ukraine and against the war on the whole. And indeed, they do come across and face additional persecution, you know, not only being arrested, but also, as you said, either beaten up or threatened with rape. We have come across cases where women who were arrested were badly beaten in the police stations. We have come across the case where actually a man, for instance, a poet who was arrested was raped. So, you know, unfortunately, the women, of course, are facing, you know, also the problems where, for instance, if you are being prosecuted criminally, you know, you risk to be deprived of contact with your children. And there is a case also mentioned in the report where exactly that happened, where an activist was put in pretrial detention, and at the same time, her son, if I remember it correctly, was taken away from her. So yeah, they're paying very high price, and they need support, all these activists, and this is also very clearly stated in the report that all these people, they need ongoing support from the international community. It's very often you can hear that, well, you know, it's all doom and gloom, what can we do about Russia? Well, if there's no support at all, if these issues are not raised continuously on the international fora, it will be even worse, and we risk even further deterioration of the situation.
This report, which was made public this week, never before has the UN Security Council authorized a rights expert to examine rights issues in one of the permanent members of the Security Council. What's the significance of that?
Well, I think finally, you know, the international community woke up to the fact that, unfortunately, or fortunately, I don't know, the world order as we know it needs a change. Security Council probably need reform of some extent. You know, the powerful countries, if they are violating human rights, need to be taken to the account fully. So indeed, it is quite significant that Russia has been taken to account on this level, on the level of special procedures looking into the situation. It also shows that Russia is very bad in engaging with human rights mechanisms in the UN. Otherwise, you know, probably we wouldn't have come to this situation. And again, you know, coming back to the report, Madam Special Rapporteur has pointed it out very clearly in the very beginning of the report, where she says how Russia selectively engages with human rights mechanisms, how none of the standing invitations to special procedures have been issued, how Russia refused blankly to even cooperate with the Special Rapporteur on this country. So if Russia thinks that this is, you know, a clever move, you know, we disengage and nothing will happen, I think they're making big mistake. It is always better to engage in the dialogue, and then perhaps improving of human rights situation could also help to improve Russia's internal situation, you know, outlook on Russia from the international community and from the outside of the world.
Natalia Prolutska, Russia expert with Amnesty International. Thank you for being with us. Russian President Vladimir Putin on Wednesday formally accepted an invitation to visit China in October. It would be Putin's first known trip abroad since the International Criminal Court issued an arrest warrant against him over the deportation of children from Ukraine, an allegation the Kremlin denies. On Wednesday, Putin was hosting Chinese Foreign Minister Wang Yi for talks in St. Petersburg. And we've been reporting on and talking about Russia's war in Ukraine since February of 2022, and regularly hearing about the use of drones in attacks and also defense. My colleague Steve Karish spoke with Cameron Chell, CEO of drone manufacturer Dragonfly, which has been consulting with the Ukrainian military about many projects.
We started off by doing medical delivery drones. So we were using drones to deliver insulin into besieged cities. So our drones have a temperature-controlled mechanism that can carry pharmaceuticals and organics and things like blood or insulin and such. And so we were delivering those into besieged cities where ambulances couldn't get into at the beginning of the conflict. Today, we're doing ISR missions, which is reconnaissance-type missions, and we're doing primarily landmine detection.
How does a drone detect landmines? Are you using cameras to see the landscape, or do you have other technology on board?
It's multiple sensors. So we use RGB cameras, we use hyperspectral cameras, we use LiDAR cameras, we use magnetometers, which detect metals. We use thermal cameras to detect plastics at different times of day, depending on the temperature that they are and the variances in the heat of the plastics. We've used some ground penetrating radar. So it's a varying amount of sensors that then create maps of the areas and then provide intel to the demining crews.
Sounds like a lot of equipment to carry. And with the other drones you mentioned delivering insulin, these must be pretty big to carry that much weight. How large is one of these drones?
Yeah, so a typical drone, which is the Commander 3XL that we use. It's about the size of a coffee table is about the best way to think about it. So it's a 22-pound drone. It carries 24 pounds of payload. So it's, you know, an incredibly efficient drone. And it comes in both an all-electric or a hybrid type of setup. So in the electric version, it can fly for about 50 minutes. And in the hybrid with the gas engine version, it can fly for about 3 hours.
Are any of the drones you make combat drones? Do they carry weaponry?
Our drones could be adapted for many uses, and we have provided drones into different military departments, you know, who may or may not be using it for those purposes. Yes.
What's the difference between a commercially available drone, one that I could go to the store and buy, say, for photography, versus one of the ones you might give to a military customer?
Yeah, so those are typically the ones that you're talking about on the consumer, or, you know, often what's referred to as the prosumer side. You know, they may range anywhere from, you know, $1,000 up to $5,000, and they have, you know, terrific, you know, control capability, and they have terrific camera capability. But the drones that we're talking, and you know, and they're about the size of, you know, it, sometimes as small as a large phone or a laptop type computer size. The drones that we're working with, price point wise, probably start around $50,000 to $70,000. Have anti jamming, electric or electronic warfare countermeasures. You know, much more long distance capability, significant amount, much more training to fly them because of their size and the weight and the cost of the payloads that you would be putting on them. So it's, you know, kind of like the difference between, getting a driver's license, to drive on the road, and or, you know, being a heavy equipment operator, and the experience needed to run like a big cat, or something like that would be an example.
I got to say, with all of the technologies available in the world, and I don't only mean military technology, it seems like a really fun job to have, sitting around with these awesome, huge machines, figuring out what you can do with them, and then going out and doing it.
You know, we just spent 2 days in Texas at our joint air facility with 30 different federal and state agencies, and I've never seen a happier group of individuals just flying these incredible machines and pulling incredible data and doing missions that just weren't possible before. So they're not toys, but they're a lot of fun to work with.
What's the future of drone technology look like? Where are we headed?
Well, you know, drone technology is to me is very similar to the internet, where when it first came out, it was like, wow, this could be practical. You know, I could put this thing called a website up, and people could, like, an electronic brochure. I'm not sure why I need it, though. I mean, I'm in the yellow pages, and, you know, but people didn't really understand that the impact of the internet was everything from GPS to apps to all of our communication to, I mean, today, it sociologically, I mean, it's a fundamental of how we organize our lives. And drones are really that same thing. If you're not really in the industry, you're like, hey, that's pretty cool. I can take pictures, and it doesn't cost me as much now because I don't have to fly an airplane, and I can fly sensors, and, you know, obviously the military aspects are obvious, but the reality is that drones will be as pervasive as the internet. So it's the beginning of all humanless conflict. So Ukraine has demonstrated that in very short order, it's going to be the machine-to-machine war out there. And on the commercial side, or on, you know, the homeland side of things, everything from, you know, the delivery of your packages to the inspection of infrastructure to security is all going to be done by drones. I mean, they're just so highly efficient.
Cameron Chell is CEO of Dragonfly, a drone manufacturer that, among other things, is helping Ukraine with mine detection and battle drones. Cameron Chell, thank you for your time today.
Thank you, sir. Have a great day.
And that'll do it for us today, but stay up to date with continuing coverage on Ukraine and news from around the world 24 hours a day at voanews.com. And on social media, just follow VOA News. On behalf of all of us here at VOA, thank you so much for listening. Until next time, I'm VOA's Lori London.
This is the voice of America. Washington, D.C.